Think Again with Borderlands Cooperative.
Join us for critical conversations about things that matter.
Every Friday at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial.
And 3CR Digital, streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
So together, let's think again about important matters affecting us, like economics,
politics,
education,
health,
climate,
and what we can do about it all.
Welcome to our 337th program of Think Again. Think Again is a program of the Borderlands Cooperative, which has been working for social change for over 28 years. We're broadcasting today from the Wurundjeri lands of the Kulin Nation. And Womanjeka, welcome. My name's Mari Brennan. I'm the chair of the board of Borderlands Cooperative in Footscray. And I'm here again today with Emeritus Professor Rob Hattam from Adelaide University, who's joining us by phone from the lands of the Kaurna people. Welcome back, Rob.
Yeah, hello, Mari. Thanks very much for inviting me again.
Oh, that's very nice. And it's good to have you here to follow up the last session, which was rather a damning logic of what was going on with the current policy regime. And I particularly liked your use of Pasi Solberg's term, germ. We've been infected by a germ, the global education reform movement, and its associated knowledge grifters who try to, you know, capitalise on them on selling knowledge to policymakers. And this time we want to discuss what good social science might be, not just the bad sciences, that might inform education for the future, a good education. And so while we look at some of those false claims of the science of education, we want to contrast that with what we want, which is good social science to help build schooling that's future-oriented and placed in now. So, Rob, yes, over to you.
Well, just to sort of, you know, maybe summarise my argument from last time as sort of a place to begin, and, you know, maybe the title for today's, you know, talk would be, you know, in defence of a good social science and education, which is what I've been arguing for most of my career, actually. But anyway, you know, picking up on some of the points I made last time and maybe, you know, a bit more sharp-edged. Those claiming a so-called what works learning science, or even sometimes referred to as a science of teaching, aren't practicing good social science. And, you know, as examples, the evidence for explicit instruction is not in, the evidence for systematic phonics is not in, cognitive load theory can't be claimed as irrefutable evidence for explicit instruction, meta-analyses of randomised classroom trials are not the most reliable form of evidence. ERO doesn't have privileged access to truth about good teaching. You can't claim to have found the holy grail of teaching. Brain science doesn't validate once and for all the truth claims of cognitive load theory. And there's a huge archive of educational research now being sidelined by those boosting a science of teaching, or what works learning science. And more importantly, the practical wisdom of teachers is now seemingly irrelevant to policy logics.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, you know, just to finish off my little rant there, in the name of science, we need to be reclaiming a strong version of educational social science against the narrowed, technicised version that's now become paradigmatic. And that means demanding that government re-engages respectfully with the huge archive of qualitative studies and works with the immense amount of practical wisdom about good teaching that is extant in our schools.
Well, I mean, the problem then is that the bad science has actually captured the public discourse, and the political arena suggests that what we want is good solutions to the problems that are named by the bad science, and they don't want to be told it's much more complicated like that. It's different in every class, every year. But, you know, doing learning science or just do phonics or providing explicit instruction scripts for teachers seems to give the politicians answers, and that amounts to this whole what works kind of dribble. And so good social science, I think, has to refuse universal truth claims. So we've got to pay attention to the context and the place and people's practices. Instead of trying to find laws that work in every case, we need to think about what good social science, what works in this place.
I suppose if you're thinking about your first riff, what's government up to here? Why have they been sort of captured by this sort of narrow technicist form of what's been called science? I guess historically governments are desperate to control the work of teachers.
Yeah.
And certainly for as long as I've been in the game, there's been lots and lots of talk from, you know, our side of the ledger anyway, about teacher-proofing what goes on in classrooms. And not surprisingly, you know, those governing at present quite like the sort of, you know, what works learning science, because it's got all the answers. And teachers' voices are suppressed. We can roll back commitments to autonomy for the teachers and what goes on in schools. And we can say over and over and over, we've got the answer, we know the truth, we've got the evidence. Why aren't you implementing it? But then again, of course, those of us that have been studying the history of science can remember in our university early days when teacher education did those sort of things, that the social sciences emerged more than maybe 150 or 200 years ago, and in the early days they had to ape the positivist physical sciences. But then in the last 100 years there's been a huge amount of scholarship in the social sciences about how inappropriate a positivist science is for studying society and the way people behave with each other. And there's been the emergence of different epistemologies which have different criteria, but unfortunately we've sort of fallen back into a dominant positivist science, and just a bit of a riff here against a positivist social science. The good social science, we think, has a strong commitment to being empirical. It's sceptical about its own truth claims. It's transparent. It's more humble in the truth claims that it makes. It provides explanatory power. It's non-coercive. It works off a critique of its own truths. It's sensitive to how power works on and through knowing. There's high levels of verisimilitude, i.e., you know, that rings true to me. As you want to point out, most importantly for the short time we've got, It's context dependent. To make a universal claim about what's going on in every classroom can only be banal, actually. It doesn't can never say anything serious. Good social science is reflexive about the role of the researcher. It's collaborative. It's interdisciplinary. And good social science and education works a theory-practice challenge.
Yes. And I think we've got plenty of examples of what works against that kind of scientistic approach of that claims truth all the time, in the kinds of work that you and I have both been doing for many, many years, which is to work with teachers doing research themselves. And I think that reclaiming the good social science at all levels, but in particular at the local level, at schools, with teachers and also with students who need to be equal partners in their own education. You know, we need to actually be thinking about what makes it possible for teachers to be doing research, to invent new ways to make education not just accessible, but a vehicle for building different futures in conjunction with the students and their communities.
I think that's absolutely right. And I don't know, even on its own terms, the notion of sort of claiming what works, in some sort of broad sense, I don't have much trouble with the trope, other than the version that's dominant at the moment is sort of, you know, making universal claims about what works, where I think the research we've been doing has really been pondering what works here.
Yeah.
And paying particular attention to, you know, the specificities of context. And
yeah.
I don't know if we're on about trying to develop evidence or knowledge about good teaching, then good teaching must involve our responsiveness to the unique, singular character of every classroom. Mm. And hence, one-size-fits-all highly scripted rituals can never cut it. And so, you know, the methodologies that we've been using have attempted to have a dialogue between university researchers who, you know, try to read an archive that's sort of international with the very sort of specific challenges that are presented to teachers in every classroom around the country, in which case, for us anyway, good social science research is a dialogue or a collaboration between, you know, university researchers and teachers as researchers of their own practices, which sort of then feeds you into if you're going there, then running surveys or sort of research that's sort of done on teachers is highly unsatisfactory. And I suppose one of the things that's most important, if we're trying to make an account of good teaching, at some level it's got to be highly theorized practice knowledge. And the only people who are really, really up for developing, you know, theorized practice knowledge are teachers themselves. So good social science and education has to be working with teachers.
Yes.
And of course
they've got to do it with their students too.
I mean, again, you know, back to the definition I was writing there, you know, good teaching must be responsive to the unique, singular character of every classroom.
Yeah.
In which case, learning a scripted ritual and coming into any class and trying it out on people as though that's going to work no matter what the context is a complete, banal waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
To be responsive to the unique, singular character of a classroom demands a dialogue between the teacher and the students.
Yes, and I think following on some work that has been some interviews and discussions that have been happening recently on this program, Think Again, on the theme of democracy, if young people don't get a chance to actually participate in their own education, helping to make decisions, researching things themselves, actually learning to work with each other across their differences, then they won't learn how to be democratic. And so the idea that an authoritarian policy regime and an authoritarian pseudoscience that's going to tell us what is going to work and all we have to do is not ask why, but just how high do we need to jump, is not going to actually provide good education, and it certainly won't build in a experience of democracy that is absolutely central. Because if you don't understand and learn how to research with people, then you're not going to be able to you're not going to be able to participate as an active citizen in a very diverse society. And for me, that's where, I mean, I was thinking of the project that you were doing with Professor Lester Irabina-Rigney on culturally responsive pedagogy, culturally responsive, because we've never really taken account of in schooling in the British Empire and its legacies now, we've never taken account of Indigenous knowledge systems. And we need to be doing that in Australia, and that has to be part of our education. So can you say a bit about that project and how it works with teachers researching and documenting good teaching and the barriers and the issues that come out?
We'd just start with a few broad brushstrokes. But, you know, one of my favourite sentences that I've crafted in the last couple of years is that, colonisation's a monologue.
Mm, yep.
So, you know, Australia's got an unfortunate history of sort of colonisation, which is still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see how whenever there's sort of a coloniser move, there's a desperate attempt to shut down the voices of people that are sort of really suffering. And we only hear one voice, mm-hmm. the voice of the coloniser. So here we are watching how a one-size-fits-all explicit instruction approach is now being sort of mandated, and it's really sort of mandating monologic teaching as opposed to dialogic teaching, where really, really good, skillful teachers can engage in dialogue with their students about what should happen in classrooms and connect strongly with their life worlds and their communities.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, our study, we've had two goes at it. So Irabina and I, 7 years ago or 8 years ago, decided that we'd apply for an Australian Research Council grant, which we titled Towards an Australian Culturally Responsive Pedagogy. And the basic argument we made was the country's really struggling and suffering from a appalling learning outcomes for Aboriginal kids around the country. Mm. There's been 30 years of policy failure, which has now sort of culminated in a sort of a deficit policy called Closing the Gap.
Mm.
And meantime, other settler colonial countries around the Pacific Rim, pick New Zealand, Canada, some parts of the US and so on, same colonisation process. For about the last 20 years, there's been really hopeful stories around what's being referred to as culturally responsive pedagogy. And when we looked in the Australian context 7 or 8 years ago, we could only find a couple of references to culturally responsive approaches. So it was almost the key word culturally responsive was almost completely missing from the discourse in Australian education.
Mm.
So. And we made the argument that given how hopeful it was in other countries, let's see whether or not we could develop an Australian version of that. And we managed to win the ARC grant and using, the previous basic definition of good social science that we quickly had a go at 7 or so minutes ago, we ended up engaging with about 10 high schools that are in disadvantaged communities in mostly Adelaide. Most of them were from the northern and western suburbs of Adelaide. And for 2 years, we ran a whole year action research cycle with 3 or 4 teachers from each of the schools. Each year, culminating in a conference where they presented in a public space about what they'd learned. And then in the third year, about 3/4 of the teachers helped us develop case study accounts of what they'd gotten up to. And basically, one of the things which is completely missing from the What Works archive is narratives of practice.
Mm.
So, and there's just banal, here's the truth, implement it, which is hopeless for teachers, really. So we developed a website, and if people wanted to access it, all they need to do is to put into their web browser culturally responsive pedagogy, one word, no gaps. We own the domain name, so our website comes up as the first hit, and you can find about 40 or 50 case study accounts of teachers across our two studies that have been engaging in culturally responsive approaches. Basically, our action research model it's been sort of developed in what was the University of South Australia over about 30 years with Barb Comer and you and I and a whole range of others. And there's sort of 4 basic moves. The first move is what's your challenge in your classroom?
Mm.
So good social science needs to start with the challenges of classroom teachers, not coming up with here's the answer. So and the second move is, what's going to be a hopeful idea out of the culturally responsive archive that you could use to redesign what you might do as a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
They engage in some redesign of a curriculum unit they're going to teach in the third term. they do something different in the third term and collect some data to ascertain whether or not anything sort of positive happened, and then they develop a presentation for a public space in the fourth term, i.e., what did I learn, which then becomes a sort of a platform for having another go in the second year. So that's basically how our model worked. And then the second study, we decided that in the first study, the site for change was an individual classroom teacher. But what we started to get worried about was the teachers go back into their school, and how are those new practices being supported or sustained at the level of a school? So the second study, which is again funded by the ARC, was named the Culturally Responsive School.
Mm-hmm.
So we've developed a model for how a school might take responsibility for transforming classroom practices towards being more culturally responsive.
So what kind of infrastructure or practices at the school level seem to make a difference for the schools that were involved? How many schools were involved in that?
I think we had about 6 or 7 schools. Again,
right.
Mostly in sort of, northern and western suburbs of Adelaide. We did have one. We had one country school.
Okay.
We had a very large Catholic school. The sort of infrastructure. First of all, you need a leadership group that's got a skill set and can confidently engage in forms of professional learning that have got a chance of transforming teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a crisis across the sector. The middle leaders of schools that are responsible for professional learning haven't been well skilled in using sort of action research approaches for about 20 years.
Mm.
So the way our model worked is that we ran our whole of year action research approach for about four or five teachers from the participating school. So they went through our process.
Right.
And then in the second year, they were supported to be leaders of professional learning in their school and use a variation of our action research model with their own staff.
Mm.
You had sort of intellectual and resource support from the leaders. You had some teacher leaders in each school that were confident in running professional learning for their teachers because they'd gone through it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the sort of key, really.
Yes. And how did you identify the or support the leadership group the senior leadership group?
Well, in the second study, in the first year when we were just running our sort of fairly basic action research approach,
yep.
we met with the principals of those schools a number of times,
right.
and try to support them thinking out aloud with each other about what they would do in terms of professional learning in their school context. And obviously we've got sort of a model of whole school change which needed to be sort of tweaked for their own circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And of course when you're engaging in school change, mostly school leaders are really, really afraid that they're not going to be able to manage the resistance.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fear about trying something new. They're afraid that at the beginning of the year that they're going to be announcing something new to the staff, which becomes quite problematic. So each of the schools needed to had to develop a narrative about how what they were now doing was sort of building on what the school had been up to for the previous few years. So
right.
Sort of helping the leaders sort of with their own sort of internal narratives about transformation became really significant in the first year.
Yes,
and
I
then
can see that. Yeah,
and then in the second year, we would meet with the sort of school principals mostly one on one actually, because the methodology changed from basically supporting an action research approach to being a sort of whole school ethnography actually in the second year. So we had a team of about 5 or 6 of us, and each of the CIs, the chief investigators, was running sort of a partial whole school ethnography for the second and third year. So
yeah.
you know, the school I was responsible for, I must have visited that about 10 or 15 times in the second year, you know, talking to the principal, you know, what, how's it going, where you're up to.
Yeah.
And so on and so on. And we in parallel, we were still running workshops for all what we called the teacher leaders, which were the people that we worked with in the first year, because they were the ones that had to, you know, problem solve the sort of professional learning that they were running. So, yeah, we had sort of a double-barreled support.
That, I mean, to me, that kind of good social science, which is both very specific inside classrooms, but also deals with how the school leadership and infrastructure has to actually support that kind of approach to professional learning community building, and how that then makes it possible to do a different kind of curriculum that is actually responding to the needs of the whole country as well as this particular place. And I think there's so much documentation about how schools are really, and teachers are terrified of dealing with Indigenous issues, and they don't understand what resources they could use. They don't understand what pedagogies they might, you know, teaching methods that they might build, and how to actually be responsive to the cultures and knowledges of the whole of Australia that is represented in their classroom. Now, I mean, we're going to have to pulling this down to the end here, Rob. Is there one last 1 minute that you'd like to say?
Yeah, well, probably just picking up on your point there, when it comes to what the system's providing around teaching across cultural difference, okay, and our study started off being focused entirely on, you know, appalling outcomes for Aboriginal kids. But in the end, it became a study that was interested in cultural difference more generally. So picking up on the, you know, cultural differences of Aboriginal communities and, you know, the sort of refugee immigrant communities that are sort of, you know, inhabiting our classrooms. So when you go and have a look at what policy offers, it offers Aboriginal perspectives across the curriculum. It offers cultural competence or interculturality, and all three of those fail.
Yeah.
And in some part, most often they fail because teachers just don't feel culturally comfortable in being an expert in Aboriginal knowledge or so on and so on. So our model of culturally responsive provides a different framework, which we've proved over and over and over, because we did the action research for about 5 years. Our model doesn't have those problems.
Yes, that's right. And so we'll continue this conversation at another time, Rob, and think about some more of the features of that kind of collaborative university, school and community participation. So thank you very much for coming on today again. And we'll, in a few weeks, we'll try and do a third version. But now I need to make a community announcement, which is that...
Thanks, Mary.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rob, and see you soon.
See you, bye.
Bye. Community announcement is that there is the Palestine rally will be on again on Sunday at 12 o'clock at the State Library. And we can't forget about the Palestine rally, because it, despite other places having bad things that cause us to think about Ukraine, cause Lebanon, the Arab Emirates and Iran, we can't forget Palestine. And Palestine, you're in our thoughts and hopes, and we want to stand in solidarity with you on Sunday at 12 o'clock at the State Library. So thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Think Again live on 3CR Community Radio today. If you want to contact us or give us feedback, you can email borderlands@borderlandscooperative.net. Our programs are available by podcast on a variety of platforms and on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. Meanwhile, please enjoy Milkumana by King Stingray.
listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.